Good afternoon and welcome to MMA Talk for Pro Wrestling Fans for the week of March 25th, 2018. I am your host, Robert Vallejos, coming to you not live this week, but a different new format that we're trying out on the show. I'm going to take the show offline. There's some upsides and there's some downsides to this. The upsides to this is we'll be able to record more consistently. We can go longer form on some issues that we don't always get to discuss in real time. The downside is we're not going to be having the regular phone calls that we did, but that doesn't mean we want to stop hearing from you. We always want you to get at us, MMALivecast@gmail.com. That is MMALivecast at gmail.com, or hit us up on Twitter at MMATorch, at MMATorch, and stay tuned, guys. There might be even more ways to get in touch with the show and get a hold of us and have your voice heard, even in print form, to what's going on in the world of pro wrestling and mixed martial arts. This week, I'm joined by my partner in crime over at MMA Torch, Zach Hadorn. Zach, how's it going this morning?
It's going great, Robert. Going great. Glad to be here.
Saying this morning just sounds completely off. I'm used to this being in the evening, so we've got some kinks to work through here, guys. Not as many kinks, though, as USADA apparently has to work through, because there's a ton of big stories this week in MMA. Not any major fight cards we're coming off of. There's no major fight cards this weekend. Some good stuff, some LFA, some Invicta. But I think the biggest story was one Josh Barnett being vindicated by USADA, effectively becoming the first UFC athlete to go to arbitration with USADA and come out with only a public reprimand. So he is free and clear and can fight. For those who don't know, back in December, he failed an out-of-competition test with USADA, testing positive. He appealed the suspension, went through the whole thing, and this past week, it was deemed that he was absolutely in no way, the substance in his body in no way as an illegal performance enhancer. The substance did become in his body, but it because of a tainted supplement for a training supplement that he was taking, and he was able to prove that. So USADA's take on it was, yes, he did fail a test technically because that substance was in his body, but there was no malicious intent on his behalf. Now, of course, he doesn't get back the year that he lost. The guy's, you know, in his 40s now, so that's a very valuable time that he will never get back, but his name is clear. Zach, what the heck does all this mean for both USADA and for the UFC?
Both sides are in a really weird spot. And when I heard this story, to be completely frank, you know, my initial reaction was that this is how it's supposed to go in a lot of ways. I mean, you know, if the fighters are supposed to be able to have the ability to challenge USADA's results, and if they have reason for doing so and can actually prove it, then they should be afforded that opportunity. To me, on the surface, this worked as designed. You know, there he was flagged for doping. He said, "Hey, I didn't have anything to do with this." He took it the steps needed to get cleared, and in the end, he did. So, it's tough to say that, oh, you know, USADA messed up, or man, the UFC shouldn't have them because of this false positive. But to me, it's like this is what the system is designed to do. It's unfortunate, to be sure. Like, no question, it's an unfortunate circumstance. But if you look at all the tests that USADA administers and all the fighters it deals with, it's not like this is happening on a regular basis. In this particular instance, all the correct protocols were followed. And in the end, he got his suspension lifted and just received a public reprimand. So I think it's a tough situation, because for as hard as it had to have been for Josh Barnett to go through this process and to deal with the false positive, I think the system worked in a lot of ways, even though he had to sacrifice a year of his career to showcase that. From the UFC perspective, I think they should look at it that way. They should look at it as, hey, you know, we've implemented this system. This process played itself out. Yes, it took a long time. Yes, it was unfortunate. But this, you know, I think they want to have this outlook for their fighters to go through if they really believe that there was an issue with the USADA test. So I didn't have a problem with it. I can't understate just how unfortunate I think it is. But this USADA is not perfect. No testing system is. That doesn't mean there shouldn't be one. And that's my mindset on it.
Yeah, USADA is kind of weird because they're such a mixed bag, I think, for a lot of people. I think on one side, people just feel that they are killing the sport. They're kind of the equivalent of the NCAA Enforcement Committee, that in enforcing rules that people aren't sure actually help or hurt anybody, they totally take everybody out of competition. Like, we don't have Brock Lesnar and we don't have John Jones because of this. At the same time, I think drug testing is a necessary part of MMA.
Right.
And of sports. And USADA doesn't get credit for how flexible I think they are in these situations comparative to other sports. Have you ever heard like of an NFL player ever winning their appeal against the drug testing in the NFL? No, and it's always this hardline stance of you're responsible for what you're putting in your body, which there is some merit to that. But in the case as where Barnett could prove that he took every precaution necessary and it's still a He still got bit by it, but he was able to be vindicated in the process to an extent. I do think some people are comparing this to John Jones. Well, John Jones is the opposite. Even if he's technically in the same situation where there was no way he could have known he was taking a banned substance, you don't go before your appeal hearing and say you've never taken the orientation and all that,
right,
that he did. So I don't think they're analogous really in any way. I think the biggest issue that we have with USADA in general, aside from, you know, what the role they play in fighters' privacy, but on this side of the microphone, I think we have to look at their timing and their expediency and how they deal with things. I think that's such an issue, particularly in MMA, and it can go both ways. If you think about all the way back to the infamous UFC 200, where Jon Jones and Brock Lesnar, again, tested positive for the same substance, and one of them fought in that card, and one of them didn't. You know, that's a key sticking point in Mark Hunt's lawsuit. Was he fighting a fighter that was tainted? At the same time, you know, Josh Barnett loses almost over a year and a half of his career because the process just took so long. I think we need to see a little bit. All forms of arbitration in this world take a long time. Sometimes that's for the better to get the absolute clear facts out there. But I think in these situations, the process needs to be sped up. Now, I will mention this, that Barnett had said in the past that they were trying to get him to basically settle, take, you know, sort of the equivalent of a plea agreement and serve a suspension and let this be over with. Barnett was able to ride it out. Barnett's been fighting for a lot of time. He probably has some money saved up. He can do that. He's got the gig with New Japan, so he's got other income. Not every fighter can survive a year-long layoff like that, and I think that's something that definitely needs to be considered. Where do you come out on the whole issue of how quickly USADA does their operation, Zach?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right on all accounts. I think the process took place as it was supposed to with something like this, but it does need to happen quicker. And I think and that's certainly an area in which USADA can improve because, you know, look, hopefully these type of things aren't commonplace moving forward, but if they are, you really – it's hard and it's unfortunate to make fighters lose a year and a half, or even, you know, 9 months of a career. You know, that's the prime money making time for them. And I do think for as successful as the process was here, I do think that they need to figure out a way to speed the process up so they're not causing such a delay from when the positive test hits, all the, you know, the legal mumbo jumbo thereafter, and then a final decision. They just need to pick up the pace on that so these fighters aren't losing their prime time, their prime of their career, essentially, to handle a drug suspension. That takes too long. But hopefully that's something that they can clear up. Well, I'm sure it's easier said than done, but even a little bit faster would be something that the fighters can knowingly keep in their back pocket as they deal with USADA in the years ahead.
This is something that we're going to talk about later on the show with a totally different competitor in the world of combat sports. But do you think that when these things happen, should fighters or athletes have legal recourse against the state? Should they be entitled to financial compensation for being put out of action for this amount of time?
God, that is a really good question. And man, gosh, I guess my initial reaction is I don't know. I think Tough question, because I don't, maybe it's a situation. I don't think you should, if you actually failed a test and you know you did, and you're just going to appeal just to, you know, keep collecting some money while the appeal process happens, I think there's an issue there. So maybe it's something where you're compensated at the end of it all, whereas, like, you know, you go through your process, and if for some reason, hey, if you were dinged for a false positive, then you get some sort of back pay compensation. But I don't think it's something where you should just get paid throughout the entire process. That's for sure.
No, and I'm with you there. I think it would only be in the case of a false positive. But, you know, I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know if at what point does a fighter advocate their ability to collect on that. But I think it is interesting in general. Like I said, we'll talk about this later, maybe when we talk about Daniel Bryan, of how much, when a piece of your career is taken from you, how much compensation are you owed as a result of that. And it's in the whole pantheon of fighter pay issues that we seem to talk about every week. And that's something that not a lot of people have brought up, because there's probably a clear-cut answer to it. But it's something that I think probably should be explored in some sense. Zach, I got to ask you, though, too, before we go to our first break. If USADA were to come test you, would you test positive for wine?
Oh, my gosh, yes. Lots and lots.
Well, after this podcast, we're going to have an intervention with you. But before that, let me tell you about Wink. That's WINC. It's Wink Wine. And what Wink does is it makes it easier to discover great wine. Because Wink's wine experts select wines matched to your taste, personalized just for you, and it's shipped right to your door. And best of all, the bottles, they can cost as little as $13, which, I mean, we're all kind of, you know, splitting the dollar as far as it could go these days. That's not a bad value. You know, and there's nothing like coming home to a box of delicious Wink wine that's selected just for you. It's the best day of your month. You know, for some of these guys, when USADA shows up at the door, that might be the worst day of their month. But, you know, for me and Zach, when Wink comes to our door, that's the best day of our month. All you got to do is fill out Wink's palate profile quiz and answer some simple questions that your average store clerk wouldn't ask or translate into a recommendation. Questions like, how do you take your coffee, or how do you feel about blueberries? Then Wink sends you wines that are curated just to your taste. The more wines you rate, the more personalized your monthly selections. Each month are new delicious wines, like the insanely popular Summer Water Rose. There's no membership fees. You can skip it at any month, and you can cancel it at any time, which is great. And of course, shipping is covered. And if you don't like the bottle they'll send you, they'll replace it with a bottle you'll love. No questions asked. USADA asks a bunch of questions. Wink, they only ask the right questions to get your wine selection down just right. Discover great wine today. Go to trywink.com/pwtorch, and you'll get $20 off your first shipment. That's trywink.com/pwtorch for $20 off. That's trywink.com/pwtorch. Okay, Zach, let's go to a break. And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about fighter rights and discuss what Joe Rogan said about win bonuses. Let's go to break.
PW Torch Livecast listeners, I'm Wade Keller, and I urge you to be sure that you're also subscribing to the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcast at Podcast One and the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show. All you have to do is search Wade Keller in Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast app you use on your Apple or Android device to subscribe to both feeds. There's a red brand covering Raw and SmackDown every Monday night and Tuesday night, and it's downloadable a couple hours after the show. And then there's also the Wade Keller Podcast Flagship Edition on Thursdays with a rotation of co-hosts, including Jason Powell from ProWrestling.net, Todd Martin, Bruce Mitchell, and others. And then there's our Interview Friday Edition. Every Friday, I'm joined by a guest who has worked in the wrestling business, including ex-WWE creative team members like Kevin Eck talking about Drew McIntyre.
Drew was a young guy, and did it go to his head, and did he walk around like he was the chosen one? He did, and I was frank with him, and I said, Drew, just so you know, this is how they view you.
And Podcast One's own Christian Harloff talking about his days working for WWE and Vince McMahon specifically.
As far as their perception of him, I mean, he's the king. He walks in, and it's just, you can feel it. I mean, if the force was real, you would feel the force. powering into the room when he enters.
And pro wrestlers, including NWA World Heavyweight Champion Nick Aldis, also known as Magnus, talking about the challenges facing Ronda Rousey as she transitions from MMA to WWE.
Think about, like, the press conferences and stuff like that. They just, someone tells them, like, all right, now it's your turn, go out there, right? I'm sure if you ask Ronda, she'd probably say, this moment is the result of hundreds of people's work, meticulous preparation and planning and timing and everything. And now suddenly it's like, go. And that can be very overwhelming.
Just search Wade Keller on Apple Podcasts or anywhere else you listen to podcasts.
Don't forget, you can email the show at any time, MMALivecast@gmail.com. That is MMALivecast@gmail.com. Okay, let's talk about something Joe Rogan recently commented on. And I've said in the last few months on the show that ever since Joe Rogan signed that final contract, or I should say his most recent contract with the UFC, where he's only on domestic pay-per-views and only on the really big show, it seems like his tune changed a little bit. I would still consider him a shill for the UFC, but it's not as blatant as it once was. You know, everything is not all right with Dana White and the UFC in Joe Rogan's world all the time anymore, which I think is a positive given the platform, particularly with his podcast. I mean, he's the king of podcasters right now. So what he says has a great deal of influence on how people perceive things. He recently stated that he believes that the win bonus system should be eliminated from the UFC. And in a nutshell, his reasoning was that judging in MMA is so very suspect. Not to say that it's necessarily rigged, but there's a lot of decisions that seem very close or could go one way or could go the other way, and a lot of really questionable decisions happen when it comes to scoring. Therefore, the win bonus should be eliminated. What's your take on that, Zach?
Well, my take on that is on the surface, right out of the gate, I don't believe that win bonuses should be completely disregarded. I think there is a place for them. I think people want to know that, you know, that these guys are fighting for something, and I think it's more, you know, believable that, hey, the winner of this fight gets more money. I don't think that applies to every single fight. I think super fights and things of that nature, you know, big time fights of between big time stars, certainly there's a shade of gray there. But overall, I don't personally mind the win bonuses. That said, looking into exactly what Rogan said, I think there's just an infinite amount of issues with just the words that are coming out of his mouth. I mean, he's talking about judging, and he's talking about judges throwing fights or throwing results or having, you know, wrong opinions on purpose. And I, to me, if that is a concern of Joe Rogan, like that's the bigger issue. I think that just surpasses the whole fight bonus thing, because you're talking about a sport that's heavily reliant on judges calling these fights down the middle. And if, you know, like, as you just said, the UFC quote unquote shill is out there discussing that, hey, these judges might not be legit, I think the sport and the company have a much, much bigger problem than how that factors in to the win bonuses. So hearing these comments, you know, on the surface, like I said, I disagree. I think the fight bonuses have a place, but my ears perked up with all these different things he was saying about the judging of these fights in the UFC, and that bothered me more than anything else.
That's a very interesting point, and I didn't quite have that takeaway, and maybe that said something that I didn't have that takeaway where I just, oh yeah, you know, the officiating is just bad and possibly crooked and all this. But I do think the UFC does skate on that a little more than boxing. Boxing's been around for a bazillion years and has such a poor reputation that we sort of accept that there is corruption and there's illegitimacy within boxing. Well, the same people that regulate boxing regulate mixed martial arts. And I feel like because we're so much more likely to get a definitive finish in mixed martial arts when somebody just KOs somebody, there's nothing refereeing or judging or scoring could do to undo that result. With that said, I think there is plenty of poor decisions in MMA week after week after week. And it's funny because in the early incarnations of the Dana White era, that's one of the things he would sort of campaign on for MMA that you get good officiating, but I think it's actually much more difficult to officiate MMA than it is boxing, because there's so many different dynamics and so many different martial arts, and what being successful means in one discipline doesn't necessarily translate to the other discipline, and that comes out in the cage when everything's being blended together. On the win bonus thing, I don't like the bonus structure in general in the UFC, because it does seem too much like a, you know, if you're in Dana White's good graces, you get the win, the bonuses. The win bonus, though, is the one that they're, you know, there's an arbitrary line of you either won or you didn't. So I do like that. I know some have said it doesn't actually incentivize fighters to go out there and give it their all. It incentivizes very safe and boring fights, which is something that's interesting. But I don't think a fighter would – I think if a fighter is going to be safe and boring, they're just going to be safe and boring. I mean, that's what we heard about Ryan Bader, that he was so worried about getting the win bonus in the UFC that when he went to Bellator, suddenly, you know, he was going to turn into Conor McGregor or something, and that didn't happen either. It just – he was a wrestler, and that's his style. You know, I think Tyron Woodley has proven, because of the value of the title, that something you got to do what you – to do to win. But every athlete out there is going to want to win. So I don't think that necessarily plays into it. I have seen in the past, though, where if someone who was robbed of a fight does receive a win bonus, and I think that's actually admirable when the UFC does that, when it's just completely blatant that person won the fight. Yeah, I don't have a strong opinion on the win bonus. I would like to see bonuses in general eliminated. But a win bonus is a nice thing. And like you said, super fights, it doesn't really make sense because of the money that's going to come into those fighters anyway. Plus, sometimes those things are structured so one-sided where no matter – even if that fighter gets a win bonus, they're still going to make so much less than the other fighter. Right. So I think the A side in those situations should never get a win bonus. I don't think in the last couple of fights, I don't think Rousey had a win bonus that was going to come to her, but it would have came to her opponent. Fighter pay is such a tricky thing. I think everybody wants fighters to make more money. Because of the secrecy surrounding their contracts, I don't think any of us really know how any of that actually works. So we only ever hear about it from disgruntled former fighters, which that's a perfectly valid claim. But like, we never hear somebody in the prime of their career, you know, there hasn't been a bunch of great leaks with these contracts for us to really evaluate it on a level to make a super informed decision. I do wonder, though, at some point, like, is Joe Rogan going to get the axe because he keeps saying these things so flippantly? Or do you think, like, the UFC doesn't even care anymore? What do you think? What do you think the dynamic is there?
I mean, look, Dana White, the UFC, could not have possibly been thrilled by these comments. And like I said, even if you take out maybe them being unhappy about him talking about fight bonuses, I mean, he's out there talking about crooked refs and crooked judges. And that's like, you know, that killed boxing. And if that sentiment gets tossed out into the fight marketplace from anybody, but especially let alone a guy that's in the back pocket of the UFC right now, that could be a real problem. And he's got to be careful with where he goes with this, because not only is his, you know, career tied to the UFC and to MMA, that would kill the company. So I don't think he's going to get fired or anything over these comments, but I do think the UFC is going to tell him, hey, tone it down. Like, that's ridiculous, number one. And number two, you know, we don't talk about those things, because it could send the sport and that company down a road that it definitely does not want to go down. So I moving forward, I think he's going to be careful about those kind of things.
Yeah, it kind of, if to make it to a wrestling analogy, it's kind of like how Bret Hart or Dave Bautista are these days, where they will just say anything. And they're not really worried about the consequences, because if their relationship with the big company is severed, they still have enough capital, at least in the fans' eyes, to make a living other places. And that's the thing that we haven't really had in MMA a lot. I think even like a Conor McGregor still tries to keep up somewhat of a relationship. And I think his contentious relationship with the UFC is more of a show than anything. So it's interesting to see how these comments get construed and get processed through the UFC brass in this new era where we don't hear from the UFC a lot, I feel, anymore. The next story we're going to talk about, we'll talk about Dana White saying that the TJ-DJ fight is potentially off. And we'll talk about that now in a second. But it just dawned on me when I'm reading the article, like, yeah, he declared this – Dana White declared this in a text message to the LA Times. which seems very un-Dana White of him. Like, I would expect him to be there on, like, FS1 screaming his head off, saying, like, what a loser Demetrius Johnson is for being hurt and for being short and any other thing. Like, this is another example, I think, maybe of the broken spirit Dana White that people are talking about. The UFC, since the WME IMG buyout, they're very quiet on a lot of things. They take action, but they don't explain their actions anymore. They used to explain too much, and now they don't really explain hardly anything at all. But let's talk about TJ Dillashaw and Demetrius Johnson being off as a fight, according to Dana White. Is this the classic, if Dana said it, the opposite's going to happen?
I mean, I don't know how you couldn't have that opinion, just knowing the history of Dana White and him saying these kind of things. Nothing else appears to be in the cards for either of those guys right now. And maybe it's not something that happens here in the next 1, 2, 3 months, but I just don't buy that this fight won't take place. It makes so much sense from the point of view of DJ and TJ. It makes sense for the UFC too. I mean, why not put on an event with that fight headlining it? I think you'd do good business. It'd be an interesting fight that people would want to watch. Because of all those things on the side of this fight should happen, Dana White coming out and saying otherwise just leads me to believe it's posturing in a negotiation, either with fighters or either fighter. I'm not sure, but to me, that's what this screams. I think Dana's trying to negotiate here. He's trying to present it as, hey, we don't need this fight, but in reality, I really think they do, and I think it makes sense for their 2018 year, and I still do think it will happen.
I think it'll happen as well. I think the issue is having it on that same card with the other two, with the other super fights, with Stipe and Daniel Cormier. Yeah. And so, you know, you want to have, like, the card of super fights, which sounds awesome. But as we've seen, the UFC does that, and then they have a barren landscape for, like, 4 months after that. Whereas DJ TJ could be the headliner on a card that won't sell as much, but still will feel like an important investment in everybody's time. And here's the thing, though, and I sound like a hypocrite, because before in the show I have said that I think that fight would be best on an undercard of a massive card and something that really people could get invested in, because I don't think it could sell on its own. With that said, it still is a good enough fight that if you had to put it on its own, you could do a lot worse than that fight. Go ahead, Zach.
Yeah, no, I was going to say the same thing. I think, look, in a perfect world, if you had, you know, the year mapped out and you had all these, you know, significant fights that are going to, you know, main event pay-per-views from now until December, well, then, okay, then I think you could load this onto a card like Stipe and Cormier and then just make that show just a must-see super show. But it doesn't appear that the UFC is in that position right now. They need, you know, even if it's a B-level main event pay-per-view fight, they need to be able to diversify a little bit and spread that out. And like you said, I think this fight can hold a pay-per-view card on its own. And if it can, it should. So I'm on Dana's side with that. If DJ and TJ are posturing on their side to get this fight onto a major card like that, so the buy rate goes through the roof. Look, I can respect that as businessmen trying to make the most money that they can. But from a promotional standpoint, I'm not sure it makes sense to do that right now. So if Dana's trying to move this to a different event, I think that is the right call. And for as much as Demetrius Johnson and Dillashaw don't like it, if they want the fight to happen, that just might have to be what takes place.
And they're going to have to be careful here, because regardless of how much MMA diehards like both TJ Dillashaw and, to a lesser extent, I guess, Demetrius Johnson, this is going to be the biggest fight either one of these guys ever has. Neither one of these guys has ever really drawn on their own. And there's just interest in this fight. There's interest in the possibility of Demetrius Johnson being knocked off his throne by someone with a ton of power like TJ Dillashaw. So I do think that this fight is the most leverage they're ever going to have, but they need to take advantage of it in the most appropriate way, because it's probably the biggest payday that either one of these guys will ever get.
Right, you're spot on, and I totally agree. Like, you know, you gotta posture and you gotta negotiate to the best of your ability, but part of that negotiation is knowing when your leverage runs out. And with Dana White coming out and telling, you know, major media outlet like the Los Angeles Times that the fight is over, I think you may have to look in the mirror and say, okay, I think my leverage might be over here. If I want this to take place, it's the biggest fight that I'll have in my career. I as long as it's booked, just be happy with that, get paid a whole boatload of money, and fight when he tells you to.
The choice of outlet, I think, is very interesting that it wasn't TMZ for a change, because TMZ has become like the unofficial mouthpiece of everything irrelevant going on in the UFC. So anytime someone has something to spout off on, some Mayweather-related thing, or you've it always goes through TMZ. Like, TMZ is the conduit to getting, you know, of how the UFC gets their message across. So I did find it interesting that this came out through not an MMA website, but through a very mainstream media entity, one that isn't, of course, TMZ. We talked earlier about getting the show on Twitter, people getting at us. We have gotten some response from none other than Ryan in Maryland, who was a very regular caller to the show with a lot of questions. I think his question specifically will benefit from this format, because we'll have a little bit of time to take a look at him and think about him. One question he did send in this week is, he wanted to know, Zach, if there's ever been a loser leaves town match in MMA where the losing fighter had to leave a promotion. That this is actually very timely, because if you watch Impact Wrestling, which is about five people in all of the country, they did their Feast or Fired this week, and that got a lot of attention. Zach, can you recall a blatant Feast or Fired fight in MMA?
No, I can't recall something like that happening. I mean, the closest is guessed at someone's, you know, official retirement fight. But I think going into those fights, everybody knows certain fighters leaving anyway. So, no, I don't think it has happened, nor do I think it will happen in something like UFC, because I don't think they're going to openly just start kicking people out the door if they lose fights. So can't remember one, and I don't think we'll see one here in the near future anyway.
I actually think loser leaves town fights happen all the time. They're just the worst part of every card in general. Like, there's always two guys on a three-fight losing streak that you know the loser is not going to hang around a lot. It's not exactly a promotional tool in MMA the way it is in pro wrestling.
No.
It doesn't quite have the same cachet. I mean,
right? You're not gonna have Conor McGregor versus Nate Diaz in a loser leaves town.
And the gimmick that the UFC will be promoting is you like to see these two guys, and after this, you won't be able to see one of us. Like, that'd be very stupid thing for them to do in general. It works a little bit different in pro wrestling. And if I'm not mistaken, someone like Bruce Mitchell could really expand on this. The whole idea of the loser leaves town match is really more of a territorial concept.
Right.
You know, the guy getting a little stale, you know, in Florida or in Oregon or whatever, he loses that fight, then he goes on to the next territory, and he's freshened up, and then he comes back a few months later. That would be a heck of a – now I'm thinking about it. Maybe I do want to see that in MMA, but just with fighters that people hate but promote it to, like, the top. Think of two really boring – okay, Phil Davis and Ryan Bader. They could have had in the UFC a loser gets demoted to Bellator fight. And everyone, like, who do you root for? Because you don't want to see either one of those two fighters necessarily. Yeah, I'm on board. Thanks for that, Ryan.
Yeah, and you know that they would, you know, turn up the volume for sure, so they wouldn't have to be relegated to Bellator. So, you know, that's I'm seeing dollar signs, man. Dollar signs. Good job, Ryan.
Yeah, that's what we're here for. We're here to book weird things. And, you know, we say these things, and, like, 2 years later, they end up coming true anyway. So, you know, anything could happen. On a much more serious note, Ryan wanted to know if there were any male fighters in MMA that are openly gay and have their opponents ever kind of cut the promos on them revolving around their sexual orientation. I tried to research this a little bit. There has been openly gay fighters, but they seem to be, on the male side at least, on the lower levels of MMA. I can recall this happening in boxing before. Where the guy's opponent had thrown a lot of slurs his way and he was promptly knocked out. An openly gay male fighter isn't something the UFC has confronted yet. Any thoughts on that, Zach?
No, I mean, I can't think of one. That doesn't mean that they're not out there, certainly. You know, and look, it's 2018. To me, this it's a non-issue. It should be for the company, and it should be for fans. So, gosh, I mean, in a situation like that, if an openly gay male fighter were to come out and be in a fight and you had another guy, an opponent, you know, going at him for that, I think that would, A, that'd be bad business for the fighter and it'd be unfortunate occurrence for the sport. It's something that I just don't want to ever see happen. I don't think it has any place in MMA at this point in time. So, gosh, I mean, hopefully that never comes to that. Let's leave it at that.
Yeah, and if any sport would be unequipped to handle that situation, it's definitely MMA.
True.
I don't know how you would say, like, the alt-right fringes that are still very much invested in MMA. It would just be a disaster if a fighter took the promos to that level, which someone could. You could see, like, a Colby Covington, even if those weren't his true feelings, using that to sell a fight. So I don't necessarily think that, you know, the fighters themselves would be would make the spectacle out of it, and it wouldn't be such a big thing. But I could definitely see some gaslighting by a very small but vocal segment of the MMA audience.
Yeah, I don't. Unfortunately, I don't think you're wrong about that. I just as a company, as a massive company, mainstream company that the UFC is right now, to me, if that type of thing started happening, they would have to take control, nip that in the bud, and make sure it didn't happen again, because it paints them in a bad light if that's happening on their watch and on their distribution channel. So I don't think that, yes, that feeling could be out there. I think UFC would absolutely squash any sort of sentiment to use that as promotion if it started to go down that road. But like I said, hopefully we don't get to that place and nobody decides to make a name for themselves off of some terrible words like that.
And I said how the UFC or MMA would be unequipped to handle it. With that said, I think on the positive side, the UFC would handle something like that a lot better than, say, WWE does. That, you know, they would do less patting themselves on the back as these sort of beacons of social change that we see, like, every week, where I'm not denigrating them for taking the action. Like, I think it's great that you have women in a prominent position now on TV. Like, that's so long overdue, and it actually has improved the product by a lot. But we don't need to hear every week that they deserve so much credit for doing it. I think the UFC is a little more subtle in how they handle their things at times, and I think would handle that just a little bit better.
I completely agree. I mean, you know, and to be frank, I mean, you know, the UFC was positioning women on their cards in more prominent positions long before WWE was.
If anything, they facilitated it. They were
exactly
the ball rolling, and, you know, just to prove from a purely monetary sense that, okay, yes, women, people like women combat athletes. I think that they owe that to the UFC, actually.
Yep.
Totally. All right, Zach, let's go to another break. We come back, let's talk about, speaking of Colby Covington, the guy comes up on every show, and we talk about getting yourself over. Talk about his rumored scheduled fight between RDA and for an interim belt. Also, we'll debate Ronda Rousey, we'll discuss Ronda Rousey's video on Monday Night Raw this week. I have a feeling it's going to turn into a debate. And I have a fun little, maybe kind of a fact or fiction that I thought of during the last break. So we'll see you on the other side.
Rich Fan, formerly of the Primetime Friday Livecast with Bruce Mitchell here. I want to tell you about my new show, The Deep Dive with Rich Fan. On Saturdays at 6 p.m. Eastern weekly, join us as we dive into a single subject, some weeks as serious as race, gender, and stereotyping in wrestling, to as fun as which IC champs could fit into another era, and anything in between. We'll have guests from inside and outside the Torch family to cover the subject of the week, and of course your calls and emails. Prior to each episode, I'll put out on social media the subject and some notes, places where you can also bone up on the subject of the week if you're so inclined. I'll also devote shows to two of my favorite international promotions, New Japan Pro Wrestling and Progress. All are welcome. No secret handshakes here, because Saturday nights on the livecast are officially all right for diving.
So this past week, a report from BJPenn.com, take that with whatever grain of salt you will, came out that the UFC is targeting an interim welterweight title fight between Rafael Dos Anjos and Colby Covington. Zach, does this make any sense at all? Not the fight itself, but for it to be for the interim belt.
No, it makes absolutely, to me, it makes no sense. I think the fight makes sense. I think, you know, the fight and for where they're targeting that fight to take place, I think that makes a lot of sense. But I don't understand just throwing an interim championship into that mix. There's really no need for it. I mean, Woodley defended his title quite a bit last year, three times, and he's injured now. He's coming back at some point this year. I just don't see why you would lump that in just to lump it in. I really don't want to see these interim titles just be props to sell fights as title fights. Everybody and their brother knows that this isn't that. I think people understand that that there's no need for an interim title in this division right now, and I just think you should leave the fight as is, have it, promote it, and then just leave it at that.
You know, Zach, you make sound reasons and arguments. I just don't care about the interim belt situation anymore. Neither does your dog, apparently.
Well, yes, my dog hates interim title
fights. He's disagreeing with me. No, I hate interim titles when they're completely unnecessary. And what I mean by that is, like, when a fighter fights 1 month and then the next month they book an interim title fight because they don't think he's going to be around. Basically, the lightweight situation is when I can't stand the interim title fight. We don't even know what Nurmagomedov and Ferguson are fighting for in a couple of weeks. That still hasn't been clarified.
Oh, God, I know.
In this case, I don't think it's the worst thing in the world because it's essentially a number one contender belt. And the fight will probably happen, in this case, from whoever wins this probably does get a shot at Woodley. So I don't think this is the worst scenario. And I'm just tired of being so angry about interim belts. I guess they've beaten me down. I accept it now. That's a fact of life that we're going to get these interim belts all the time. Now, to your main point was there's a stain on the incumbent champion when you have to make an interim belt. Like, oh, they're not available or they're not injured. Yeah, Tyron Woodley got injured, but Tyron Woodley has said he has been able to fight in the interim for the right price and the right fight. Now he's taking his time to recover if that doesn't come along. But like you said, part of the disdain towards Tyron Woodley is we've seen him so much. Because he's been a very active champion defending. He got taken a little off course by the two Wonder Boy fights, and then he dispatches Maya. Fairly easily, fairly tactical. So I don't even know if I'm making any sense here. I don't have the venom to, this is not the hill I would die on in the interim belt situation.
Yeah, I don't want to die on the hill either. I just think, I mean, I guess the interim titles, they still get me. They still make me react. And I'm a Woodley fan. I think he's a good fighter. I think he understands the fight game and he understands the value of being that champion. That said, he hasn't been trying to, you know, dodge opponents for a year like a Conor McGregor or somebody of that nature. I mean, he's fought, and when he comes back from injury, I think he's going to fight again. So for me, in this case with this division and this champion, I just don't see a need for it. And I just a little more fired up about it than you, but hey, it is what it is.
One last thing on this topic. Are we ready for a world where Colby Covington can technically call himself a UFC champion?
Oh man, I'm not. I hey, you know what? If this was the WWE and you had this interim championship fight and Covington was the guy and he came out victorious and was leading to a fight with Tyron Woodley and you could, you know, book it as a wrestling storyline, I think it's great and I think it would do big business. But man, he just rubs me the wrong way, and I don't like watching him fight. I just don't like seeing him being featured in prominent positions, and he bothers me. And if it does come to Woodley versus Covington, I will just as much of a fan as I am an analyst of Woodley in that fight, and just really want him to dust Covington as quick as possible.
Yeah, being a derivative of Chael Sonnen isn't exactly the greatest or most enduring gimmick ever, especially when you're not as good at the smack. Like, it's more mean-spirited than actually creative, I feel, from what Chael used to do. where there seemed to be an artistry of what he did to steal your gimmick over there, Zach. Whereas I don't think there's anything artful about what Covington is. He's just a jerk. Like he's just
right,
a troll.
Right.
Like, he's just blatantly a troll. I don't feel that there's much calculation in what he does. Although I feel like it's worth being. But this kind of ties into what we spoke about earlier in that if that fight were to be made down the road, I mean the baby face of the situation should be Tyron Woodley. But something tells me that the promotion would somehow backfire. And the whole thing would be about getting the title off of Tyron Woodley and getting it to Covington. Like, I'm very worried at how that would play out, but I'd be with you on there that I would maybe drop some objectivity and roof. I like Woodley and can admit that his fights are boring. Like, I don't think that those things are totally incongruent with each other. I don't know why it has to be one or the other. George St. Pierre fought a lot of boring fights, and everybody always liked him. So I don't know. The fighter excitement not necessarily tied to how much you like the fighter or want that fighter to do well.
Totally. And I think from an MMA fan, someone who's going to watch all the shows and buy the pay-per-views, et cetera, you can respect Woodley and cheer for a guy like that. I completely understand why he doesn't draw casual fans to the product because that's not the kind of fighter he is, but he is a winner and he is a good champion. And I think that is something to respect in this day and age.
Intelligent dude too, if you actually hear it when you listen to him talk.
Yeah,
he's actually pretty interesting. Let's talk about something kind of fun here. One last complete MMA sort of subject. I'm gonna do a quick impromptu round of fact or fiction with one question, Zach, and you have no idea what this is. So, fact or fiction? You are more interested in seeing Mayweather versus McGregor in a UFC octagon. Or Donald Trump versus Joe Biden in any setting fight each other. Now, to our listeners around the world, not aware, Donald Trump, obviously president of the United States, Joe Biden, former vice president of the United States. They're now going back and forth at who could beat the other one up in high school, which is great. It's like two old jocks, complain about who was the better football player 40 years ago. # democracy wins. Zach, what fight would you rather see?
Oh man, gosh! Here's the thing: as much as I would like to see someone knock Donald Trump out, I have to go with Mayweather against Conor McGregor at this point. I don't think seeing two 60-plus-year-old men rolling around an octagon is a good thing for the world right now. So I'll go with Mayweather against McGregor, begrudgingly, because there's not a big part of me that wants to watch that either. But I think, Robert, you found the lowest fact or fiction possible with this question. Congratulations.
Well, this whole show really has been about scraping the bottom of the barrel. Let's see. I found myself the other day breaking down like Trump versus Biden from an actual stylistic standpoint. And then I realized I needed to get a life. I'm like, wow, Biden's got all this energy and he's very aggressive, but Trump's so mean-spirited, and he would do things that he would go to the. And what am I doing? Wait, what the heck am I doing in my life? I gotta get back on track here. This is American politics at the moment, folks, has really driven, I think, most Americans just away from everything we do, and it's what we focused on. It's filled the void that sports used to. Sports is more so that escape now, but even in sports, we can't escape that. But I think who would promote Trump Biden? Would Dana get in that, or would, like, Don King?
Bellator, perhaps?
Yeah, because it would depend who would come for it, because, like, there's connections between Trump and Dana. Like I said, Trump and Don King, they have a past relationship. Trump's hosted a lot of combat sports at his things. Yeah, I think Bellator would be the fairest. Ryzen. Forget that. Ryzen.
Oh, yeah.
Ryzen has to – the fight for the soul of our nation has to take place in Ryzen.
Oh, no. So you got to answer now. Which fight would you rather see?
Oh, Trump-Biden, clearly.
Okay, all right.
And
two old guys, all right.
Because, Mayweather-McGregor in MMA would be a very short affair. And we've already seen the build to that. The build to Trump versus Biden in Ryzen would be amazing. Biden would be going off on the microphone at rallies. Trump would be tweeting these things at him.
Yeah, you're right. It would. Yep. It would. But see, that would be the kind of circus show that Bellator would just totally love, don't you think?
Oh yeah, and both of the guys are like over the age of 80, so that's right in their wheelhouse.
Right. Washed up guys.
All right, let's get serious for a minute. Do my Lance Storm gimmick over here. Let's talk about the Ronda Rousey video this past week on Raw. Zach was doing some reporting in real time on Raw. Recommend you check that out. Nice side-by-side comparison with him and Wade Keller kind of doing the same thing, but taking their own takes on it. It's amazing when two people who are pretty like-minded, I would say, but you can come away with different conclusions. It's very interesting watching the same thing. But Zach, you seem to have some praise for the video package that the WWE rolled out on Ronda Rousey. What did you like about it?
I liked the emotional aspect of it from Ronda's perspective. I think, you know, especially watching her UFC career, she's just protected herself as far as her emotions go. You never really got to see into her much. You never, you know, I never felt that you ever got a real moment from her, or a real, just a real comment from her. She was always in this, in a role and in a gimmick. And she may have been in a gimmick and in a role in the video on Monday night. I'm sure she was. But to me, she let the audience in a little bit. And I think it made her seem more likable, just more enjoyable to watch. And it just let the audience in and allowed them to connect with her more so than she did when she was fighting in the UFC. So that is the first thing that stood out, where I was like, wow, okay, she's actually talking about her losses in UFC. She's never really done that before. And again, I completely understand that it could have been an extremely produced moment, but the fact that they went there, I think, speaks volumes, and I think it'll go a long way in making her a likable figure and a likable character in the company, not just for her WrestleMania match against Stephanie McMahon and Triple H, but in the future, for future programs against maybe, you know, an Alexa Bliss or a Nia Jax or anybody down the road. I think there's a connectivity to her now because of that video that wasn't there before and certainly wasn't there in the UFC. So that's initially what stood out as something that made me give that video a thumbs up.
I think overall you are correct. I'll disagree that she wasn't, you know, emotionally available in the UFC. Before she lost, she was like a complete open book. She was very open about a lot of stuff, you know, and she literally wrote a book, of course, detailing her childhood and her past and her path to the top. Once she lost, then she notoriously became so closed off, and I think it's had a negative impact on her reputation to an extent. Obviously, she's doing just fine. So I would disagree with. The video as a whole, I think, is what they needed to do. They needed to show, you know, the audience why to care about her, and I think they hit on some of those things that the UFC did very well in promoting her. I think she was probably the most successful that the UFC's ever been in promoting an athlete. I think Conor McGregor promoted himself very well, and the UFC got on. I think the UFC themselves did a great job with promoting Ronda Rousey, and I think in this case the WWE did a great job in how that was produced, and just even how it looked aesthetically, I thought was very well done. However, I still hate the crybaby Ronda Rousey. I hate the whole "God must hate me because I lost two fights." Like, they said that, and immediately it's like, "Oh yeah, here we go again." I just like, she drives me nuts with this. Like, you lost, two fights. People lose in sporting events all the time. People lose more often than they win. It didn't break you. Obviously, you're still a big star. People obviously still care about you. And it's so ridiculous that still is her go-to. And I just thought it was so dumb to put in there. And that's why I tweeted out, like, okay, I guess Ramona Shelburne produced this video, because it's the constant we should play the violin for Ronda because she lost two title fights. Like, that is such a ridiculous thing. And so I've been so pro Ronda with everything she's done. I think more so than most analysts. I thought everything I just think it works. I think her in the WWE in general just works. They seem like a perfect fit. I do believe that maybe Ronda, she wouldn't have the star power she has now had she gone there first, but I think that might have been her destination place all along. That stuff, though, still drives me absolutely crazy. And I think that's something that will alienate her from the crowd that watched her in MMA that had that negative feeling on it. I know Rick on our show a couple weeks ago says he still kind of has that negative will towards Ronda even when he sees her on a WWE screen. So I just think that did her no favors. Am I overreacting to that one line?
I think so. And here's the reason why. I think, you know, there is a portion of the audience out there that are like you and me and Rick who you know, follow MMA extremely closely and therefore have followed Ronda's reactions to everything, to her losses and everything in between. I didn't have a problem with it because I think she right now needs to appeal to a new audience. I think she's bringing a lot of eyes to the product, but there's also a lot of eyes that have already been on the WWE that may not know who Ronda is and what she's done in the UFC to become this big star. And I think she, for as cheesy as that moment was, and I'm with you, I think it's a one-time thing. I don't think they can continuously go back to this or it will wear on the crowd. But for one time only in a video package like this that was designed to set her up and just really present her in a bigger way to the WWE audience, I was fine with it because it did let the audience in. It showed a human side of her that maybe annoys you and I and Rick because we've seen it all before, but there's a lot of people that haven't. And I think it was effective in drumming up some sympathy and drumming up a human part of her that people can be attracted to. So I think you got to take that part into consideration when looking at it too.
So I'm the guy that comes on here every week and talks about how all these analysts are living in the bubble. And so you're basically saying I gave a bubble opinion, which you're probably right. I mean, you probably are right. I think it's one of those points that sticks with people who analyzed her from that time. I don't think they should go too often either. I was thinking about that as you were saying it, because if they keep going to the fact that she lost and then came, they're basically saying like, it basically feeds into that really ridiculous narrative that is there online that she couldn't cut it in the UFC, so therefore it has to go to WWE. I don't look at them as a demotion. I look at them as similar mediums that are different that she transitioned into.
Right.
But if they keep focusing on her losses, that's how that'll come across.
100%. And the other thing about that too is I think the way it was presented too, and the way that she said it with Kurt Angle looking on, and you know, action packed videos or clips around. Her saying that, I think the way it was edited and the production on the piece just made me feel a little bit better about it. Like you said, there was times in her UFC career that she was open. And to me, it was always a protected openness and a really produced openness where she would go on late night shows and, you know, talk about certain parts of her personal life. But to me, those felt just scripted. And as I said, even though I'm sure this was incredibly scripted with a fine-tooth comb, it didn't come off that way to me. It felt a little more natural and it felt a little more genuine, which is why it worked for me.
Yeah, pre-produced segments are something, especially with MMA fight, like the way they do with Brock, someone who's not – probably like Ronda, who's a good speaker but not necessarily a good promo, I think works so well in the WWE, and I wish they would use them more with other people. Let's go to our last break, Zach, and when we come back, let's talk about what everybody who talks wrestling has been talking about. Let's talk about the return of one Mr. Bryan Danielson, Daniel Bryan. Let's go to break.
Do you love wrestling? Are you in or around New Orleans during WrestleMania weekend? Then come check out Ring Rust Radio Live from the Hilton Garden Inn New Orleans Convention Center on Saturday, April 7th from 2 to 4 p.m. local time. Tickets are only $10 and available on PayPal via ringrustradio@gmail.com or on patreon.com/ringrustradio. Don't miss the boys of Ring Rust Radio.
Well, unless you've been living under a rock this past week, the biggest news in combat sports, yes, pro wrestling is a combat sport, is the return of Daniel Bryan to in-ring competition. The man was cleared by a battery of doctors. He's been cleared for a long time by a lot of doctors, but he finally got the clearance from the WWE to resume in-ring activity. This is nearly 3 years in the making. The guy had been gone since past WrestleMania in 2015 when he suffered an injury on a European tour. He officially retired in early 2016, and then now he's back. He was on SmackDown, gave a extremely impassioned promo, one of the best promos we've seen in pro wrestling, right, ever, to be honest with you, from a genuine standpoint. One of the promos that actually has a happy ending. A lot of people give good retirement promos. Edge gave a good retirement promo, but this is one that actually led something and can be woven to storyline, which I think is great. And I would very much recommend that you check out Zach's piece up on MMA Torch, this Artistry of Wrestling column. He really broke down every different segment of the promo and explained why it worked. And it was a very interesting read to break down, you know, kind of it reinforced a lot of the things I thought, but also kind of articulated them in a better way. So definitely check out Zach's article on that. Let's talk some Daniel Bryan, Zach. I mean, this is huge. I'm still in the post Daniel Bryan fog. Friday night, I went on my deep ride binge where I got off of work, sat there, and I just watched a whole lot of stuff on the network. We talked earlier about objectivity, and you know, I thought about this with pro wrestling. I don't really care what happens in pro wrestling. Not that I'm not invested in watching. But I don't really care that much who gets pushed, who doesn't get pushed. I like to just watch it, analyze it, talk about it, and you know, Daniel Bryan, I guess, still has that connection with me where I just want him on my screen and to do well. And there's a bit of a throwback to him where it makes me feel like a kid watching pro wrestling again, where I see him on TV and I want him to win and I want whoever he's fighting to lose.
Yep.
He still has that with me, and I'm glad that still can exist in pro wrestling. First of all, just what are your overall impressions of Dee Bryant going back, and then we'll get into some of the specifics, Zach.
Yeah, no, it's fantastic. I mean, it's great on all accounts. Like, I'm assuming here with him getting clearance that he is in fact 100% cleared. I don't think the WWE would toss him back out there if there was any part of his health that was in question. So on that note, that's good in and of itself that Daniel Bryan is healthy, and that's an important thing. As far as the wrestling business goes, I mean, the WWE is getting back essentially their biggest babyface that they have right now. I mean, he has a connection with the audience and with the fans, just as you talked about, grown men like you and I still, even knowing so much about the business, want this guy to succeed, and we want him to win and be featured in a prominent position. And that is what a top babyface is. Top babyfaces have that connection. They make you feel a part of their ride, and the WWE having that back now is big. Now, I think they need to be prepared for what that means for them, which is, you know, fans are going to be less inclined to take to a Roman Reigns when Daniel Bryan is sitting there ready, willing, and able to compete and to be the top star. But it remains to be seen. But I have to think at this point that they understand that. They saw the blowback that Reigns got back in 2015 when people were pining for Daniel Bryan. They saw it the year before that ahead of WrestleMania 30. At this point, there is no fighting against it. Daniel Bryan is the biggest, or one of the biggest stars, if not the biggest star that the company has. And now that he's 100% cleared, training wheels should be off, and they should be doing everything they can to monetize his popularity for as long as they can.
It's interesting. You talk about, you know, 2015 or even 2014. I love the fact that Daniel Bryan basically ruined the Royal Rumble as a concept, just his popularity. And since then, there's always a trepidation even with the Rumble, because the Rumble hadn't been good for a long time, I don't think. 2012, 2013, 2011 was very bad. I think 2010 was considered the last really good Rumble till this previous year. But what exposed it was the whole Daniel Bryan situation. And, you know, he really, in a way, he kind of hurt the brand of the Royal Rumble in many respects. So I think they need to be cognizant. I don't think it's necessarily about he has to be the top guy with the title all the time, but just be careful that even if you as a company don't see it, people do see it. So you need to protect your other investments, i.e. of Roman Reigns, and not put him in the position to fail. by just being associated with him. It's different. It's a different type of association than like Roman gets when he's with Seth and Dean, because the Shield was a Roman was a part of the Shield. He's an integral part of that whole operation. So people like him in there. If he's just around Daniel Bryan, the part of the probably the biggest sticky point of why Roman Reigns was rejected by the audience is Daniel Bryan. It just they wanted Daniel Bryan at that point in time, and Reigns was the guy that was there. That's what's behind the whole he's being shoved down our throat. He got everything too fast. People liked Reigns until they were sort of forced to choose between Reigns and Bryan, and the choice that the company made was Reigns. That's when people stopped caring about Reigns so much, and it turned into this big thing. So they need to be cautious. I'll ask you this, Zach. Is he a much bigger star now than he was when he left?
Yes, he is. He is. I mean, absence in the fight game and pro wrestling, you know, for some guys, absence makes the heart grow fonder. And even though the WWE audience was treated to Daniel Bryan on a regular basis in the role of a general manager on SmackDown, him coming back and being an active wrestler again, it changes the game. I mean, if you think about it, when he left after WrestleMania 31, you know, remember, he was wrestling for the Intercontinental Championship in a multi-man ladder match. So even at that time, he wasn't recognized as a major drawing star. I mean, Rusev had a singles match on that show. I think that puts into perspective of where Daniel Bryan was. Now, there's no question he's a bigger star because he's going to be put into a handful of dream matches. Since he left, the talent on the roster has been just stocked with new people and new guys to have great matches with. Guys like AJ Styles, Shinsuke Nakamura. You can do another program with Seth Rollins. There's guys in NXT like Andrade Cien Almas or Johnny Gargano down the road. Like this, the stock pool of talent that he can go up against in major dream matches is just larger than it was back in 2015 when he left. So plus everybody's been invested for 2 years into him, into this project of him getting cleared again. I mean, that's been a story. I mean, we've talked about it on this podcast a few times, you know, weeks ago, 10 weeks ago, something to that effect, where it's been a looming story within WWE. Like everybody knew that Daniel Bryan was out and about seeing specialists in an attempt to get cleared. And now that he has, people have gone on that journey with him and they want to be there to see it happen. They want to be a part of that journey coming full circle. So on all those levels, you put them all together and he's a much bigger star than he was just 2 years ago. And it's because of this journey that he's went on, and it's because of the connection that he has at the root. That's at the root of everything.
Unquestionably. And I would say this too. It's kind of ironic with when they retired him, they deified him in a lot of ways. You know, they had the you know, the top name. They dedicated an episode of Monday Night Raw was dedicated to honoring his career. Well, and it
right, he had a WWE 24 about his retirement.
So they basically they enshrined him in their not into the Hall of Fame, but in their canon. I think in their mind, well, we don't have to deal with him anymore, so we can kind of rewrite history that he was the top push guy over the last few years. Well, now that he's back, they can actually benefit from that if they choose to, because they, like I said, they have deified him as a legendary performer within that company. So I think even outside of the smart internet fans, they've made that a point to emphasize over the last couple of years, so they can use that as their benefit. Additionally, he's a bit more of a mainstream star now than he was back then.
Yep.
Back then, he was really just a wrestling guy. Now, he's an integral figure on a couple of different reality shows, even though he's not, you know, they're not named after him and this and that. But, you know, I have people all the time who say, is that that's the wrestler you guys like, the little vegan guy that doesn't let his wife buy a TV and stuff like that. Like, you know, he does have that, a bit of that reach. Plus, his story is a fascinating one, like you said, because there's so much legitimacy woven into it. It's not a wrestling storyline. Him coming back is a very real thing that a very real person has had to deal with. And we've been along for that journey, and I'll give credit to David Schumacher on the Masked Man show this week. He said, you know, obviously this isn't kayfabe, but if you could book something like this kayfabe, nobody would ever have the patience to do it, but it's kind of a perfect scenario. Yep. He gave the example on his show about like when Punk was out in 2011 and then he came back the next week, like they didn't have the patience to keep him off of TV for like 8 months to really make that storyline click. You think about if you could book one of your top guys being out with an injury for 2 years and then bring him back, nobody would ever do that, but they have that luxury. And I don't think that, I think they're probably viewing him more because of his injury and because of, you know, they don't want to wear him down as a sort of special attraction. So he's not going to be Brock where he's there once every couple of months, but I think they're going to view him as being special, and it'd be pretty contradictory for them not to push him to some extent. As you said, he did kind of change the landscape of what they look for in talent. If you're going to tell me in this world that an AJ Styles, a Finn Balor, a Seth Rollins, all these, you know, smaller indie guys can be your top guys, well, the godfather of that generation is now on your roster. Therefore, he can also be a top guy. I do want to see him, though. People have always talked about, oh, now he can go against Balor, he can go up against AJ. Yeah, that's all great, and I like that. But I actually wouldn't mind seeing him go up against some of this big beef that they have on the roster now. Like, you know, they got Samoa Joe, which obviously he's faced a billion times. I would love to see him and Braun Strowman have a thing going on. I think that would be fun.
Yeah.
On a TV match, not a pay-per-view, if he were to wrestle on TV, I think even him and Jinder Mahal would have some interest to it. I think there's so many matches because that roster is like almost completely turned over than even what it was in 2015. Poor, you know, it, back then it was him and poor Dolph Ziggler kind of carrying the flag of the smaller worker guys, and so much has spread out from NXT from that point. He left right before NXT, I think, really became more than developmental. It became its own brand to really train the audience on who were going to be the workhorse guys in the future. You know, he kind of came in before even those guys were there, but before the Finn Balor, Kevin Owens, Sami Zayn, those guys in developmental. Where it differentiated itself from not being developmental and being its own brand. So it's a ton of fun. Hopefully he stays healthy. I think that's the thing that every wrestling fan needs to prepare themselves for. We see this in legitimate sports all the time where a guy comes off a long injury and we think it's going to be okay and it ends up not being okay. Let's talk about the health, though, for a minute. Is this precedent sending, do you think, in other sports? I know Seth Rollins has tweeted about that this could be a huge deal, a game changer for, you know, head injuries and how they're treated. Do you think this could have a lasting impact on sports as a whole? I mean, if we talk about MMA, head injuries are a major concern in that sport. Do you think this changes anything?
Well, yeah, I think it does. I think just the fact that this happened and this process took place where you had a guy who was, you know, for all intents and purposes, just in horrendous shape, you know, suffering all these problems. I think he talked about having, you know, seizures at some point. And I don't know the intricacies of the medical thought that goes into some of these tests, but presumably, I mean, he's shown, his brain has shown improvement from that moment, 2+ years ago to until now. And it's been trackable. And I think that's important. Now, you know, look, I'm not a doctor. I haven't seen any official medical reports. And even if I did, I certainly couldn't read them. But it's definitely a step in the right direction. I mean, concussions and CTE is such a new concept. There's not a lot of research on it until now. And now doctors are looking at it. Now specialists are looking at it. Now big sports organizations like the NFL and the UFC and WWE are looking at it. And when you have big organizations like that with a lot of money and a lot of money invested in talent, whether it be on the WWE's performance side or just from an athletic side in the NFL, when that money is invested there, you can bet that these companies are going to want to shell out whatever they have to learn as much about this injury and this condition as possible. So I don't know how big of a step it is. I don't know if it is a quote-unquote game changer, but it's a step in the right direction. It's a step that progress can be shown, and it's a step that shows that maybe someone's future isn't as doomed as it would have been 3-4 years ago.
Yeah, if Daniel Bryan's not an exception to the rule, if what happened with him is something that can occur, I think it actually could be massive across the sports landscape.
Yeah.
Even, you know, 20 years ago, when apparently we knew nothing about concussions, it was always the rap was that you can't ever, the head never gets better. You know, I remember like Steve Young back in the day.
Right,
once
right.
he started getting a concussion, it was this cumulative thing. You know, it's different than a knee or an elbow. You know, a doctor technically can repair your knee and get it back to as good as new. It's always been believed. It seems like at least it's been communicated to us non-medical people that the brain cannot be repaired from its original state. And there's been some mixed reporting too that maybe Daniel just didn't have. He wasn't as badly injured as initially thought.
Right.
Some people have talked about the nefariousness of the timing. I don't think that's that big of an issue. I think it's been the momentum's been getting positive, and then once you figure out, okay, we have a WrestleMania coming up, can we get to clearance? I don't think that's that complicated of a thing that needs to be analyzed in this way. That now they're just clearing him because they have WrestleMania coming up. No, I mean I think he probably could have been cleared back in December, but they don't really need Fastlane to have Daniel Bryan on.
Right.
I've always got their position. Like people have always how come all these other doctors are clearing him, but they won't? Is it because they're trying to keep him down? No, I don't think people understand. Based on empirical evidence of what a doctor would say, they would clear that situation. They're not worried about, like, they're not have a company's assets to protect. They would have the assets of the reputation of that doctor. From a company's perspective, when you have a company that's had a history come very recently, I mean, we're 10 years away from an active wrestler that murdered his wife, murdered his daughter, and then killed himself, who had the most degenerative brain of CTE that's ever been tested by Chris Nowinski or any of these other guys. It wasn't that crazy for the WWE to have that position, I don't think. What's your take on that, Zach?
No, I totally agree. I think that look, we can criticize WWE for a lot of things, and we do, but that's not one of them. I mean, the pro wrestling business and WWE and Vince McMahon for the longest time have been notorious, right or wrong, and you know, it's a sign of the times too, but right or wrong for, you know, pushing guys out into the ring when they were in nowhere where they shouldn't have been anywhere close to it from a medical standpoint and from a health standpoint. I mean, that story is all over the history of pro wrestling. I'm glad that the WWE is changing with the times on that. I'm glad that they've forced somebody like Paige, you know, to take a break because of injuries. Look, I mean, just like in the fight game, you got to protect these guys from themselves because they have one speed and they want to be in that ring if no ifs, ands, or buts about it. So I'm this process was an unfortunate one for Daniel Bryan at the same time. And unfortunate only because it took so long and it took, you know, prime years out of his career and took him away from the fans for a while. But on every other level, it was the exact right process. Look, your brain, you're not healthy enough to compete in a WWE ring. That's what Daniel Bryan was told. And he said, okay, well, I'm going to go and get healthy enough to compete in the ring, and then I'm going to come back and I'm going to prove it to you. And I don't see what else should happen there. You don't want to watch, or I don't want to watch, a Daniel Bryan who's, you know, infinitely close each and every time he steps into the ring to getting paralyzed or to getting his brain further damaged. Like, that's not something I want to see. I think it's a problem with the NFL right now. Like, I think there are people who understand the danger of that sport. And they, you know, I think even me as a huge NFL fan say that to myself, like, man, this is brutal. These guys are killing each other. And I just, you want these people's place of work to take care of them. And in this case, WWE did the right thing in making him jump through all the hoops that he's jumped through. He's back. Once he proved it, they did the right thing in allowing him back. So I don't fault WWE at all for how they handled this. I think they did the right thing. I think Daniel Bryan, maybe he doesn't appreciate it right now, but I think 5, 10, 15 years down the road, when he can, you know, take his daughter to dances and watch her graduate, I think he'll be very happy that they did.
Yeah, and you and I are both of the age where we remember that 2000s period when just everybody was dropping like flies. And how much blame the wrestling business for that? A ton. So I think because they've overcorrected on some issues that now people don't realize that, they were the villain in the black hat for a lot of that stuff. So it really – wrestling became this very dirty thing in, like, 2007 that you were almost embarrassed to – you're always embarrassed to be a wrestling fan. That's been a thing that's always going to be a thing. But for these kind of reasons of, you know, of just death and drug addiction being so associated with it, they've done a good job to repair that image, and this was part of that, I would say.
Totally. I mean, even if you look back not even 10 years ago, but, I mean, you had – CM Punk in 2014 dealing with some, you know, look, if you listen to his side of the story, dealing with some significant medical issues that were just being completely overlooked by WWE doctors. And he was sick because of it. And it's just like not long ago did stuff like that happen where it was like, hey, here, take some medicine and, you know, go back out there. Like, you know. For as much as we like watching these guys, I mean, we all as fans and, you know, analysts of the product have to look at it as, you know, these are still people out there. And, you know, we wouldn't want, you know, my place of business or anyone else's place of business to say, hey, you know, we don't care about your health. Get in here and work. That wouldn't fly there. And it shouldn't fly in the WWE either.
It's funny you bring that up. That defamation lawsuit, it seems like it's never really seen the light of day, has it, with the – with them. I'm so intrigued by whatever discovery can be unearthed from that thing. You know, was CM Punk really texting during his concussion test? Or are we gonna get more weird videos of CM Punk's backside to prove he did or didn't have a staph infection? It's funny. It's CM Punk's always the wet blanket that we throw into all these conversations. As soon as we bring up CM Punk, like, oh yeah, there was that, and there was, you know, it was just in 2014 when CM Punk was. Yeah,
like, well, yeah,
you're absolutely correct. That's another thing to counter argument everything I just said. Some people who are newer to the product always like, oh, well, this is the wholesome era of professional wrestling, the WWE. Like, really? Do you know that? You know nobody's on a bunch of stuff right now? Like, you don't know about these things till years later when you see the consequences of those actions. All right, Zach, I think we've talked a lot about, like, drugs today for some odd reason. If you think about it, we started the thing talking about drugs and people being out of action. We ended on a happier note, but we still somehow went down that rabbit hole. So I think that means it's time to get on out of here. Zach, why don't you plug the 98 things you're doing with the Torch this week?
Oh, yeah. Well, first of all, you can follow me on Twitter at ZHeydorn, at ZHeydorn. And then check me out tomorrow night for Monday Night Raw. I have the alternate take on the Monday Night Raw report alongside Wade Keller, of course. You can see that live throughout Raw tomorrow night. And then I'll be covering 205 Live on Tuesday night. And then I'll have the Artistry of Wrestling column back next weekend with analyzing in depth the arc behind the current event in pro wrestling. And then hoping beyond hope Thursday to get a take up on MMATorch.com for this week as well. So keep it locked at all those places. And again, you can follow me on Twitter for links to that work as well.
You can follow me on Twitter at Rob M. Vallejos. That's R-O-B-M. VALLEJOS. You can follow the brand at MMA Torch. Be sure to follow all the Torch brands. That way you can catch Zach on all of his platforms. You can go PW Torch, PW Podcast, PW Torch VIP. VIP is great right now. It's good to, you know, look back on 2014 and 2015, this stuff we're talking about, to see what they were saying about Daniel Bryan, you know, kind of relive his rise through people who watched it in real time and what they had to say, and maybe adjust that to what the expectations are now. I think would be fascinating. But don't forget, interact with the show. I implore you to do that more than ever before, you know, through a written platform. And like we read Ryan's questions and we were able to research it a little more than we were in the past. I would say keep that coming. Get at us at MMA Torch. Send us an email, MMALivecast@gmail.com. And of course, as I'll reiterate, follow me on Twitter, Rob M. Vallejos, R-O-B-M-V-A-L-L-E-J-O-S. I'm sure we're going to have a jam-packed show next week. It's the go-home week for both WrestleMania and for our next UFC pay-per-view, so I definitely look forward to getting up, opening up this mic and talking about all things in pro wrestling and MMA. For Zach, I am Robert, and we will talk to you next week.
PW Torch Livecast listeners, this show can be ad-free and commercial-free with a VIP membership. VIP members not only enjoy all 7 episodes of the PW Torch Livecast with no commercials and the ads and plugs edited out, but they also get ad-free addition to the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling post shows and the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling podcast. Also, part of a VIP membership and exclusive shows such as the Every Single Day Wade Keller Hotline, the 3 times a week Bruce Mitchell audio show, including a new weekly mailbag edition with Bruce, The Fix with Todd Martin that I also host, post-pay-per-view roundtables that I host, and other shows on specific topics, including the new Talking Honor podcast with Lola and Harley discussing the latest in ROH, including a review of the latest TV show. And now we are proud to announce that Alan Cunahan, known as Alan4L, has brought his talents to PW Torch after many years at The Observer, and there's a lot of excitement about his new weekly show called Alan4L's Pro Wrest Paradise, with the best coverage of New Japan, all of Japan, the UK indie scene, including the US indie scene. So be sure to become a PW Torch VIP member for as little as $8.25 a month on average, and have multiple new VIP exclusive and ad-free podcasts every day on customizable feeds on your iPhone and Android device. For more information and our sign-up form, go to pwtorch.com/govip, and you'll find out what else comes with VIP membership, including a weekly newsletter, over 1,500 back issues of the Pro Wrestling Torch weekly newsletter that started it all, ad-free access to our mobile and desktop sites, and more. Full lineup, full details, and the sign-up form at pwtorch.com/govip. Live!